Okay, I want to talk about Dylan Thomas today. Dylan Thomas is one of my favorite poets. Of course, all these people are. Every time I talk about somebody, it's a new favorite. You know, Frost, Whitman, Dickinson, they're all number one. But Dylan Thomas is a special kind of a favorite because his life was had its problems, as all of ours do, I guess. Had ups and downs. He died in 1953 from booze. I was trying to figure out some euphemistic way to say that. Drink. Just too much sauce. And he was one of... There are a lot of artists who drink a lot, but there are a lot of plumbers who drink a lot, too. So that doesn't mean artists have a market on drinking. But he was a Homeric drinker. And the guy had his own set of problems. And he came to America three times. He's Welsh. And he came to America three times to give reading tours. And every tour would be a little more disastrous, a little more rowdy, a little more rambunctious. And he didn't make a whole lot of money on any of them. I mean, what money he did make, he spent, he lost, he gave away, until he didn't make any money on any of them. There's one anecdote, two of his boys, Lou Ellen and Colum, were in a private school in Wales, and they were going to get expelled because he wouldn't send the tuition money. And his wife, Catelyn, was back there saying, "Come back, you dirty rat. I know what you're doing over there." And he was. And so that led to all kinds of problems. There's an interesting book you might want to pick up sometime called Dylan Thomas in America by John Malcolm Brennan. It recounts his three tours. And it's a very, very tragic book. Dylan is Welsh for the waves, or sound of the waves, and it fits Dylan Thomas because his poetry is so musical, and it's like the waves. I talked last week about experimenters in poetry, and how there aren't many. Robert Frost didn't experiment, and it's tough to experiment with poetry. Gerard Manley Hopkins, of course, is the great experimenter, did a lot of technical kinds of stuff with sound and alliteration and things. Dylan Thomas experimented a little bit too. So some of his poetry is a little on the tough side, not tough to understand particularly, but kind of tough to assimilate the first time if you don't have it in front of you. You're kind of at a disadvantage. If you're hearing Robert Frost, when Frost says, "I'm going out to clean the pasture spring, I'll stop to rake the leaves away, and stop and watch the water clear, I may. I shan't be gone long, you come too. I'm going out to fetch the little calf that's standing by her mother. It's so young, it totters when she licks it with her tongue. I shan't be gone long, you come too." And when you hear that, you don't need it in front of you, right? Everybody understands. But Dylan Thomas or Hopkins, the language comes so fast and so full of alliteration that if you can't follow it, sometimes it, what did you say? I almost have to read it three or four times, which we don't have time for. And if I don't shut up and read them, we won't have time for any. Just occurred to me. I think that must come from being a teacher too long. You can't say anything simply. If you can say it three ways, do it. I taught journalism for 7 years, and I almost broke myself of that habit, because if you don't say it concisely, you don't say it at all in journalism, of course. A lot of writers have been journalists. Hemingway, others. Whitman, which is hard to believe. He's so expansive. Dylan Thomas. I'm going to start off with a poem that he started his readings with, "In My Craft or Sullen Art." And this is the poem that I mentioned. Somebody was here yesterday? He mentioned yesterday that he was dead drunk for 3 days in Greenwich Village when he got off the plane. And they lost him, I mentioned it, and they couldn't find him. And the publisher said, "What in the Sam Hill did you do with a poet? You can't. How do you lose a poet?" So he wandered into the White Horse Tavern in Greenwich Village and never came out. And they finally got him out and said, "You have to give a reading in 15 minutes. So they put him on a cab, took him to the Young Men's Hebrew Association, pushed him out on stage. He promptly threw up. And they got him back, and the manager says, "You can't go on." He says, let me alone. And he fought his way to the podium, and started out with his poem, In My Craft or Sullen Art. In my craft or sullen art, exercised in the still night, when only the moon rages and the lovers lie abed with all their griefs in their arms, I labor by singing light, not for ambition or bread, or the strut and trade of charms on the ivory stages, but for the common wages of their most secret heart. Not for the proud man apart from the raging moon I write on these spindrift pages, nor for the towering dead with their nightingales and songs, but for the lovers, their arms round the griefs of the ages, who pay no praise or wages, nor heed my craft or art. That was always his opening, pretty much his opening poem. The interesting thing going on in there too, which is partially what drove him to drink so much and partially what drives an awful lot of artists and other people over the brink, is contained in these lines here. He says, I don't write, not for the proud man apart from the raging moon I write, whoever is too proud to get turned on by the moon or by beauty. He says, I'm not interested in those people. Nor for the towering dead or the nightingales and songs, which would be people like Shakespeare or Keats, the great. He says, I'm not interested in those people. Who do I write for? The lovers, their arms round the griefs of the ages, who pay no praise or wages, nor heed my craft or art. And there's the great paradox in any kind of art. The very people he's writing for are not reading him. They're out making love. They're not reading Dylan Thomas. And that'll drive a writer right up the wall faster than anything I know. And it finally, even such a likable critter as Mark Twain, in his later years, became irascible old coot, because he said, here I've written the great American novel, Huckleberry Finn, which he did. And Hemingway said, all American literature comes from Huck Finn. And nobody, who's reading it? A few people read it, but not many people read anything. That's just a truism. It's hard to live with. And even when you write about the very, quote, common person, the common man, the common woman, the common pursuits, everyday things, the common person is not reading about himself. And that just drives writers nuts. It really does. I know a lot of them who are halfway up the wall because of that. And it's a paradox that you have to accept or better not do art. Another example would be Rich Kemmerer. Some of you know Rich Kemmerer, who did the ceiling and painted the ceiling and is a great artist. I think he's a great artist. Many people do. Just opened his show in Leavenworth two weeks ago. I helped him put up the show. And he's got he does Christian art, angels floating in the sky, crucifixions, heads of Christ, beautiful things. But since he's been living in Washington, he did a lot of, Glacier Peak, some lakes, some fir trees. You know, all the people living in Washington, living in the midst of this, and some of them came in, I stood there all day and all night watching the people in and out the door. Not one bought anything. Not that you couldn't afford the prices. But that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. He's painting about their backyard, and they're still no more interested in it than anything else. He might be painting an abstract. How did I get on this sermon? I'll get back to Dylan Thomas. I was trying to tell you what drove him crazy. So he could read to these people and then see that there were reactions. He would go back to the White Horse Tavern and throw down a few more. And it made him feel better for a while. Finally got to the point where he was blacking out and fainting, and he went to the doctor, and the doctor says, your little capillary is exploding in your brain. He said, one more drink and you'll go out like a light, just as surely as if you put a bullet to your head. And that sobered him up a little, and he started drinking Coke, which I guess is better for you in that regard. And he was writing an opera. He was going to go to Hollywood and work with Stravinsky at an opera. He had just written Under Milkwood, which is a fantastic first play. And it was close to Christmas. Well, it was December of 1953. He suddenly walked out of his apartment, walked down to the tavern, and ordered 18 double whiskeys. And that's kind of an apocryphal story, but I have it on pretty good authority that that's exactly what he did do. The bartender stacked him up in a pyramid. He started drinking from the top, and when he got down, it was all over. He went into a coma and died 9 days later. And he knew exactly, of course, what he was doing. And his last words were to a truck driver standing there, he said, I'm so lonely. Here he was, the height of his fame, everybody's loving to hear Dylan Thomas offer from all the universities all over the world, and in the middle of New York City, and he's alone. Well, that's no. 39.
Oh.
Yeah. Well, Keats was 25, so but he didn't drink himself to death. He just died from tuberculosis. But well, that's another whole thing about aesthetics. It kind of makes you wonder. I remember somebody asked me, one of the some graduate students said, "How good would Keats have been if he had lived to be 50 or 80 or whatever?" Well, it's an interesting question, but it doesn't solve anything. I mean, Keats is so good now, and he died at 25. I don't know how he could have got any better. Wordsworth lived to 80, and it was terrible. So it doesn't always pay to keep writing too long.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there's a kind of a theory or going around that lyric poets have had it at 40. After 40, you don't write lyric poetry anymore. And they call up the names of people like Keats and Shelley. Shelley was 29 or 30 when he died, and Byron and all these people. Well, there's some truth to that, but then you find people like William Butler Yeats, who was 89 and still writing really good poetry, and Robert Frost was still going in his 80s, and Hardy was 60 before he decided to be a poet.
And how old was Shakespeare? 36 or something?
I forgot. I shouldn't. How could I forget Shakespeare's day? I forgot. Don't tell my students I forgot. Anyway. Here's a poem called "The Force That Through the Green Fuse Drives the Flower." Now that's all his title. Nobody titled poems better than Dylan Thomas or Walt Whitman. They both had great titles. Now I'll read you that title again, and then the second, and that's the first line. "The force that through the green fuse drives the flower drives my green age." That's the second line. Now you know what the poem's about. The same thing that pushes up those trees pushes us up. "The force that through the green fuse drives the flower drives my green age. That blasts the roots of trees is my destroyer. And I am dumb to tell the crooked rose my youth is bent by the same wintry fever. The force that drives the water through the rocks drives my red blood. That dries the mouthing streams turns mine to wax. And I am dumb to mouth unto my veins how at the mountain spring the same mouth sucks. The hand that whirls the water in the pool stirs the quicksand. That ropes the blowing wind hauls my shroud sail. And I am dumb to tell the hanging man how of my clay is made the hangman's line. The lips of time leech to the fountainhead. Love drips and gathers, but the fallen blood shall calm her sores. And I am dumb to tell a weather's wind how time has ticked to heaven round the stars. And I am dumb to tell the lover's tomb how at my sheet goes the same crooked worm." That's one of his themes, this, the oneness of everything, and how at the same time you're growing, you're dying. In Fern Hill, which I'll read last, I guess, is he uses the words green and golden all the time. "I was green and gold, green for youth, gold for aging." Back and forth, those themes. That's another thing that obsessed him, was the idea not necessarily of growing older, but maybe of losing his ability to write. Because he had written, and he had good reason to think that, he had written all of his good stuff at 21. Now when you're that precocious and that bright, that young, you've got problems. And how do you improve on that? And artists always go down the tubes of that. Hemingway, of course, was in his 60s, but still he was reading criticism that said, "Ernest Hemingway is over the hill. He can't write novels anymore." Well, who cares when you're right? Have you written "For Whom the Bell Tolls" and "The Old Man of the Sea" and mm-hmm. "Farewell to Arms"? Why should you have to write? What's next? But critics will not be satisfied. You know, what have you done lately, Ernest? And he read that. Of course, there are other things. He was falling apart in other ways, too. But anyway, it's a bad thing. And he was obsessed with this. In one sonnet, Dylan Thomas talks about being in his sewing his shroud while still in the corner of his mother's womb before he even begins his journey. The minute there's the spark of life, you're starting towards the other end. And that it was an obsession with him, too. Here's a poem called "And Death Shall Have No Dominion." I think I'll just read it and let it speak for itself. "And death shall have no dominion. Dead men naked, they shall be one with the man in the wind and the west moon. When their bones are picked clean and the clean bones gone, they shall have stars at elbow and foot. Though they go mad, they shall be sane. Though they sink through the sea, they shall rise again. Though lovers be lost, love shall not, and death shall have no dominion. And death shall have no dominion. Under the windings of the sea, they lying long shall not die windily, twisting on racks when sinews give way, strapped to a wheel, yet they shall not break. Faith in their hand shall snap in two, and the unicorn evils run them through. Split all ends up, they shan't crack, and death shall have no dominion. And death shall have no dominion. No more may gulls cry at their ears, or waves break loud on the seashores. Where blew a flower, may a flower no more lift its head to the blows of the rain. Though they be mad and dead as nails, heads of the characters hammer through daisies, break in the sun till the sun breaks down, and death shall have no dominion. Now you see that you mentioned Thanatopsis. There's echoes of Thanatopsis and Walt Whitman all over in there about we die and we become, where a flower may, a flower no more lift its head to the blows of the rain. Though they be mad and dead as nails, heads of the characters hammer through daisies. That's that idea of becoming food, if you will, for plants and for trees and for flowers and for rainbows. And in a sense, that's a type of immortality that we, you know, matter never disappears. It just, it changes. And that's another thing that he was always trying to say, show how he wasn't interested particularly in a orthodox theology of immortality or anything, but he was interested in the oneness of nature and how things keep going on. If you have any questions or comments as we roll along, be sure and stop me. A Refusal to Mourn the Death by Fire of a Child in London is a good poem, and that title can put you off. A Refusal to Mourn the Death by Fire of a Child in London. On the surface, I'm like, how can you refuse to mourn any child's death, whatever? Well, listen to how the poem goes. Never until the mankind making bird, beast, and flower, fathering in all humbling darkness, tells with silence the last light breaking and the still hour is come out of the sea tumbling in harness, and I must enter again the round Zion of the water bead and the synagogue of the ear of corn, shall I let pray the shadow of a sound or sow my salt seed in the least valley of sackcloth to mourn the majesty and burning of the child's death? That's all one sentence, though. I shall not murder the mankind of her going with a grave truth, nor blaspheme down the stations of the breath with any further elegy of innocence and youth. Deep with the first dead lies London's daughter, robed in the long friends, the grains beyond age, the dark veins of her mother, secret by the unmourning water of the riding Thames. After the first death, there is no other. So you don't get the sense of it until the very end.
Read the last bit.
Okay, this is also Thanatopsis-like, where he says, I should lie down and pull the drapery of my couch about me. Deep with the first dead lies London's daughter, you know, like the girl killed in the air raid, the Blitz in London, robed in the long friends, the grains beyond age, the dark veins of her mother, secret by the unmourning water of the riding Thames. After the first death, there is no other. What he seems to be saying is that the idea of death, period, is so monstrous that that's what he mourns, the idea that people, if we are supposedly a little lower than the angels, it seems grotesque to him that anyone should have to die. Many poets have struggled with that, not only poets, theologians and plumbers and school teachers and you name it, everybody struggles with that. One thing that used to obsess me, and I try not to think about it anymore, I take a lot of hikes around Thousand Oaks with my dogs, and I was out jogging through the hills one day and I came across this old water heater sticking out. Somebody had driven their car up and dumped it. A lot of people seem to think that hills are made for them to dump their trash, which just drives me up a tree. And there's all this junk out there. And this old water heater was stuck half in the, buried in a bank of dirt, and weeds is growing out of it. It had been there for probably years. I stopped and looked at that water heater and thought, what can I make of that? And I kept, every day for a couple of years, I'd take that same trail and I'd see that water heater. I finally thought, you know, this water heater is going to be here when I'm long gone. This dumb piece of junk And the weeds will turn to flowers, and the sheep will come and go, and the Basque shepherd will have generations of Basque shepherds, and I'll write poems, and people will read them, or they won't read them, and who cares? And then water heater's still there. I said, you talk about immortality. It's the junk that's going to outlive us all. You know? Where's the justice in that? That's what he's talking about. After the first death, there is no other. That's the worst thing he can imagine. So it's not that he has no sympathy for this girl, but he's getting at a deeper point, you see. There's some lines in there that, in that second stanza, that Dylan Thomas is that, as I said, Robert Frost, you read Robert Frost and you immediately understand him. I mean, there's just no symbols, he's not playing tricks, there's nothing hard with him at all. Dylan Thomas has sometimes, like Gerard Manley Hopkins, he has a line or two that you have to intuit. You intuitively understand it or you don't, right? And there's no way you can sit here and harangue it and say, now I'll spend 15 minutes and you're going to understand this line. Well, I wouldn't do that to you anyway, or you wouldn't sit still for it. These are those lines. And I must enter again the round Zion of the water bead and the synagogue of the ear of corn. Now, how in the world do you explain that rationally? There's no way. And yet, intuitively, it makes some sense, doesn't it? I must enter again the round Zion of the water bead and the synagogue of the ear of corn. It's that great marriage that Dylan Thomas had of physical things and eternal things or mystical things. There's something mystical about a water bead, something mystical about an ear of corn. You could say the same thing about a flower, a tree, people, everything. Okay. Wordsworth was pursuing the same thing in his great ode on intimations of immortality. And we saw the one flower, and he mourned the flower's dying, but he realized that through the flower's dying would come spring again, a regeneration. I'd love to hear a preacher say those words. I must enter again the round Zion of the water beat and the synagogue of the ear of corn. I'd fall right out of the pew if I heard that. I've been waiting and waiting and waiting. His readings were wild kinds of things. He would be drunk most of the time. It's amazing how many artists... No, I'm not going to say that. That's too general. Wasn't drunk. Well, he didn't drink when he wrote. A lot of times you can get, especially when you're teaching students, if they're least bit romantically inclined anyway, they can buy into this notion that artists have a market on sensibility and emotion, which simply is not true. You know, especially if I say they're Shelley-esque or Keats or Byron-esque, and they think I'm an artist. You know, when I see a sunset, and on and on. I deal with that every year, and I say, oh, here's another one. I just tell me what you had for breakfast, how your grades are, do you have a cat or dog? Write about that stuff. Don't tell me what artists are like. If you got a cat and a dog, and you tell me what you had for breakfast, how your grades are doing, what kind of car you have, how's your love life. I'll know a lot about you as an artist. He said, yeah, but I want to tell you who I am in the universe. I said, I don't care who you are in the universe. The universe doesn't care. Just tell me what you had for breakfast. Sometimes they think I'm being facetious when I say, I'm not at all. I want to know. So then they struggle with that, and they bring me six poems on what they had for breakfast. They said, you mean you really want six? I said, I want six poems on breakfast. And they said, that's so mundane. It's so common. It's not poetic. I said, oh, what the heck is poetry? It's about common things, isn't it? We'll start with breakfast. We'll work up for lunch and dinner and you'll be all right. Stay with me. Now I forgot what I was going to say. I digressed again. I knew I'd do that. I had a point ready, Marva. I was ready to... Good thing Jim Gamrath isn't here. He'd say, you're digressing. I had some great point I was going to lay on you about... Artist being sensible, yeah. Thank you, yeah. Boy, you got to watch my digressions. Bring me back. That's right. He wasn't drinking. That's right. He was a rewriter. That's where I was going to go with this. Sometimes the kids will think that as Dylan Thomas was such a drinker and lived such a riotous life that he must have written that way. Well, no. When he got through writing, he would go to the cupboard and bring down his favorite bottle, maybe. But he was such a rewriter that he had a knot on his finger that was almost as big as a goose egg. He would rewrite. They lived in Larne, a fishing village in Wales, and right on the estuary, and in a boathouse. And above that little cabin way up in the crag, he would go up and sit there and write. And he would make a mistake, or he didn't like a line, he'd crumple it up and throw it on the floor, and he'd rewrite the whole poem, crumple it up on the floor. You have to have discipline to do that. You can't be drunk. And he would finally, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, get so tired that he would stagger down to Brown's Cafe and drink some beer. And Catlin, his wife, would march up the hill, open the door, and sweep out all his work off the floor, 3 feet of pile of paper, and it would go floating all out like seagulls floating down to the ocean. And every time I recount that story, I cringe, because the University of Texas would pay him $500 for each manuscript, and he was always so broke. And of course, the University of Texas wasn't doing that then. They have a manuscript kind of thing now. And I could see all those manuscripts, handwritten Dylan Thomas. It's like Shakespeare's manuscripts. I'd love to grab them, but they're all gone. But my point is that he rewrote all the time. Worked, worked, and worked, and worked. I think it was Robert Louis Stevenson or somebody said, there's no such thing as writing, only rewriting. I hate to hear that. It's probably true, but rewriting is tough. Anyway, his reputation would get so rowdy that one, he would get drunk or do this or do that at one school, and University of Omaha would say, did you hear Dylan Thomas at Bradley did this? Oh, really? We got to get him on our... And they would get him, and then Syracuse, did you hear what he threw up? Oh, Berkeley. Now. So word got around, so it kind of enhanced his career. It also made him have to live up to it, you know, and he was just enough clown anyway that nobody needed to push him too much. So pretty soon it was cyclical, and he couldn't tell where Dylan Thomas the man left off and Dylan Thomas the poet began. And that's when his troubles really started, because it was all kind of merging. You know, he couldn't separate himself from his act, see? And that's kind of too bad. He wasn't writing, and he was just performing. And you burn out on performing in a hurry. And he was getting, back in the early 50s, 50 bucks, 100 bucks a performance. And, you know, today he would get 1,000 to 5,000 for 2,500 a performance. One time he went to the reading, and the dean of the college had him over, and all the faculty and a few friends invited, and he was already getting looped, and he just walked over and urinated against the piano leg in the corner, and all the people say, oh my gosh, I can't watch them. Is he really doing that? And they were all very titillated, you know. They thought it was very funny and too bad, and what a wild man he was. And then that word would get around, Dylan Thomas urinates against piano legs, you know. Well, he was drunk out of his mind, and he just didn't care. He was at that point where it didn't matter anymore, so he might as well do that. But, you know, those kinds of stories get around. You think that's all he does, was urinate on grand piano legs. Well, not true, but he did once, you know, things like that. And he did his best to seduce all the college girls that he could find on his tour, his readings, and it was never terribly difficult for him to do, interestingly enough. I wish I had a couple of pictures here to show you. When Dylan was young, he had a big mop of curly hair, bright eyes, a little kind of a pudgy, cherubic face, kind of innocent, waggish look about him, very handsome. And then when he was older, he had little round, pudgy face, jowls, and a little stubby cigar, and he looked more like W.C. Fields than anything else. And the girls were still crazy about him. Didn't seem to matter. And, of course, he was all for that. And Catlin, his wife, kept saying, dirty Dylan. Dirty Dylan. I know what you're doing. And he would say, ah, Cat, you're the only girl for me, Cat. And there's a great story once that he was reading in Houston, I guess, and he was, next night he was supposed to be in New Orleans, and there was supposed to be 1,000 people in the audience at $5 a head, and he and Kat had had one of their Homeric battles. They fought constantly, and she drank almost as much as he did, and woke up in this hotel after this big row and a reading, and he says, well, at least we have plenty of time to get on the plane for New Orleans. She says, "What time is it?" He said, "I don't know." And he opened the blinds. He says, "But the sun's coming up in the west." She says, "Dylan, the sun doesn't come up in the west." He grabbed the phone. He says, "I want to see the manager." He's going to blame the manager. So then they didn't make it at that very moment. People were stomping, saying, "We want Dylan in New Orleans." So he lost, you know, $5,000 just like that. And then she was irresponsible at times too. She would at one time took all the dirty laundry they had accumulated and just took a couple of sheets off the bed and dumped it into this huge sheet and tied it up and took it to the bellboy and said, "Take this to the airport." And she airmailed the dirty laundry to San Francisco where they were going to be there. Rather than do it in the hotel, she just airmailed a sheet of dirty laundry with, you know, little tags of Dylan Thomas on it. Well, you know, things like, no wonder they were broke all the time. Things like that. Finally, he was going to get some money, needed some money so desperately that when they were going to Washington, D.C. And meanwhile, his wife, Catlin, didn't come with him on their first two tours. She stayed back in Wales. But she realized something was, a little hanky-panky was going on somewhere. Not that anybody ever doubted it. But she's a dirty Dylan. And he fell in love with a gal named Meg in New York City. And Meg straightened him up, got him off the booze, got him to drink Coke instead, and he's writing his play and working and putting on some weight and making some money, and she was making sure, and they were living together for a time in New York City. And then Catlin decided to come over and join him on the tour. So he had to shape up. So they went to the senator's party in Washington, D.C. after reading. And his manager said, "Now listen, I've forgotten the senator's, what senator, from the South somewhere, I've forgotten where, Virginia maybe. And I've forgotten the senator's name, doesn't matter. Anyway, he was going to ask the senator for some money, alone." And Dylan didn't like to do this anyway, it was demeaning and all that. But he finally found the time, say, "Senator so-and-so, the senator came up to him and said, Dylan, I understand you're broke." Very brusque. He says, "Yes, I'm broke." And he said, "How much do you need?" And Dylan says, $5,000. He says, $5,000. He says, "If you'd asked me for $1,000,000, I could give it to you. But $5,000, who has $5,000? He said, "Well, just last week, I made sure the mafia got a loan for $20 million. He says, "If you quote me, I'll deny it. There is no mafia." This is Senator's verbatim language. And he said, this irked Dylan so much even to have to do this. And he says, "Anything else I can do for you, Dylan?" Dylan says, "Yes. Do you happen to know a nice black man I could marry my daughter to?" And he said that just to irk him. He didn't have a daughter. And the senator was outraged. He was a hardcore Southern senator and all that. And he said, "That's the trouble with you poets. You're irresponsible." And all. He said, "What you need is to have a businessman come in and clean up the arts." And meanwhile, the senator's wife was trying to seduce Dylan. And she says, "I hear you need some money," in this pathetic Southern accent. And she says, he says, "Yes, I need some money." And she says, "I'll write you a check." He says, "Good." She says, "Why don't we go somewhere where it would be private?" He says, "Where would that be?" She says, "In my bedroom, that'd be private." He says, "Oh." So they start up the stairs, and she says, "Dylan, I want you to admire my staircase," she says. Duels have been fought on it. Oh, and she says, "It came all the way from Terra." You remember from Obama? It came all the way from Terra. "Duels have been fought on it. Babies have been born under it, and brides have been carried to their nuptial nights up it," which is a stupid way to say things. He says, "Oh, good. Now about the check." She says, "Oh, well, do it in my bedroom." So they're halfway up the staircase, and Catlin comes in, and she grabs Dylan and says, "This way." And he says, "But we're about to get some money." She says, "Not like that, you're not." And starts leading him down the staircase. Well, who should be right at the foot of the staircase was Meg, the gal that Dylan had fallen in love with. And women have this sixth sense, I guess, and Catlin looked at Meg, and Meg looked at Catlin, and Catlin looked back at Meg and said, "So it's you." It just automatically knew. And immediately, and Cat had a few, ran down the stairs, grabbed Meg by the hair and threw her down, knocked over the punch bowl. All the senators were up there knee-deep in floating chunks of ice and strawberries, whipped cream, and both women went down. Dylan sat down disconsolately on the staircase, and the whole party was a row. Somebody knocked on the door, and Dylan opened it, and he said, and this stranger said, "I understand Dylan Thomas, the poet, is here." And Dylan says, "No, he couldn't come." And shut the door. He figured it didn't matter by that time. So he went, he just excused himself from there. Everybody was falling over, fighting, drinking, and creating this terrible row. And Dylan excused him and went back into this bedroom where one of the guests, the little child, was sleeping, and recited nursery rhymes to the kid. "Bob, Bob, black sheep, have you any wool? Yes, sir, tree backs wool." And he started talking to himself how he is the black sheep. And very tender scene. Well, the chaos is out in the other room. Well, this is the kind of life he had. This is the kind of thing going on. And he finally, as I said, drank in just before Christmas, started drinking again. And went into, and Catlin had flown back in a snit to Wales. And somebody called her, transatlantic phone call, and said, "Your husband is in a coma. Come quick." So she flew over. And another almost unbelievable scene. She bursts into the hospital, and there's Dylan with tubes and things, all, you know, machines. And she goes into a complete fit and starts beating on the doctor, knocks over cabinets for the instruments, flailing around. So three doctors have to grab her and sedate her, and then they put her in a sanatorium for a week to shut her up because she's just berserk. And so the whole scene, and then Dylan's body went by ship back to Wales. And interesting, poignant scene at the end of that part. Catlin comes down to the hold of the ship to just kind of be with Dylan. And there's a purser, you know, one of the guys that works on the ship was down there. And she started to recite a poem, "Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night," a poem Dylan had written for his father. And the pursers knew the lines and started to pick up the lines. And they both recited them together down in the darkness of the hold of the ship. And it was a very poignant thing. And then after that, she slammed her fist on the coffin and says, "Dirty Dylan." So her, then Catlin promptly went back to Wales and after a few years wrote her own book called Leftover Life to Kill. And I guess she figured it was time that she was going to get in her licks and said, "Let me tell you what it's like to have lived with a poet all these years." It's a terrible book. Terrible book. In fact, it's written in Dylan-esque, Dylanese, his style of talking, which was good for Dylan, but not good for Catlin Thomas. But she had a wild, woolly life after that. I didn't mean to give you all that biographical stuff. I got carried away with all that. Let me read Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night that he wrote for the death of his father. I mentioned critics a while ago. Critics will do anything, you know. They're such juiceless folks. Their opening line is, "Do not go gentle into that good night." And this one critic says, "Shouldn't that be gently?" Well, do not, now I can hardly read the poem, I get so. One of the same critics took William Butler Yeats has a beautiful poem, "The Lake Isle of Innisfree," about a nice little place in Ireland. And he says, "I will arise and go now." And the critic said, It's enough to arise or go now, but to arise and go now is redundant. Well, who cares? But I guess critics have to do something, don't they? They go to a play and say, "This play is no good," so it closes in Baltimore before it ever gets to Washington, D.C., and the backer is out $6.5 million, and the cast of 40 is out work. And critics do that occasionally. It's hard to believe that people have that much power, right? They're losing that, but there are still a couple of drama critics in the New York area who can kill a show just like that. Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rave at close of day. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Though wise men at their end know dark is right, because their words had forked no lightning, they do not go gentle into that good night. Good men, the last wave by, crying how bright their frail deeds might have danced in a green bay, rage, rage against the dying of the light. Wild men who caught and sang the sun in flight and learned too late they grieved it on its way, do not go gentle into that good night. Grave men near death who see with blinding sight blind eyes could blaze like meteors and be gay, rage, rage against the dying of the light. And you, my father, there on the sad height, curse, bless me now with your fierce tears, I pray. Do not go gentle into that good night. rage, rage against the dying of the light. I read a poem yesterday that I'd like to repeat today, Fern Hill, because I think it's my personal favorite of everything Dylan wrote. There's two poems. Poem for October, I think is the name of it, and Fern Hill are companion pieces. He wrote about, and he went back to his uncle's farm in Wales that he used to play on when he was a kid. Poem in October and Fern Hill. I'll just read one of them. Fern Hill, okay? He's about 30 when he wrote this, recounting his childhood days. And there's a couple of lines in here that I mentioned before that are the kind of lines that you have to intuitively understand or you don't. Now let me give you those lines ahead of time. Once below a time, I lordly had the trees and leaves trail with daisies and barley down the rivers of the windfall light. Well, there's not much you can do rationally with rivers of the windfall light. It's just a beautiful line, and it means something or it doesn't. Here's another one. The Sabbath rang slowly in the pebbles of the holy streams. Beautiful. Here's another one. He's talking about creation, which is one of the greatest descriptions of the creation of the world. He says, so it must have been after the birth of the simple light, in the first spinning place, the spellbound horses walking warm out of the whinnying green stable onto the fields of praise. Nobody did that better than Dylan Thomas. I'm still waiting for the preachers to echo that one, too. See, Marva, you're going to have to store all these up, and I'm going to...
Just think of that if I ever come.
Oh, yeah. You come to CLC, I'm just sit there, mouth open, expecting to hear all these great lines.
Yeah.
All right. This is Fern Hill. Now, as I was young and easy about the... Excuse me. Now, as I was young and easy under the apple boughs, about the lilting house, and happy as the grass was green, the night above the dingle starry, time let me hail and climb golden in the heydays of his eyes, and honored among wagons I was prince of the apple towns, and once below a time I lordly had the trees and leaves trail with daisies and barley down the rivers of the windfall light. And as I was green and carefree, famous among the barns about the happy yard and singing as the farm was home, in the sun that is young once only, time let me play and be golden in the mercy of his means. And green and golden I was huntsman and herdsman, the calves sang to my horn, the foxes on the hills barked clear and cold, and the Sabbath rang slowly in the pebbles of the holy streams. All the sun long it was running, it was lovely, the hay fields high as the house, the tunes from the chimneys, it was air and playing, lovely and watery and fire green as grass, and nightly under the simple stars as I rode to sleep the owls were bearing the farm away. All the moon long I heard blessed among stables the night jars flying with the ricks and the horses flashing into the dark. And then to awake, and the farm like a wanderer white with the dew come back at the cock on his shoulder. It was all shining, it was Adam and maiden. The sky gathered again and the sun grew round that very day. So it must have been after the birth of the simple light in the first spinning place. The spellbound horses walking warm out of the whinnying green stable onto the fields of praise. And honored among foxes and pheasants by the gay house, under the new-made clouds and happy as the heart was long, in the sun born over and over I ran my heedless ways. My wishes raced through the house high hay, and nothing I cared at my sky-blue trades, that time allows in all his tuneful turning, so few and such morning songs, before the children, green and golden, follow him out of grace. Nothing I cared in the lamb-white days that time would take me up to the swallow-throng loft by the shadow of my hand, in the moon that is always rising, nor that riding to sleep I should hear him fly with the high fields and wake to the farm forever fled from the childless land. Oh, as I was young and easy in the mercy of his means, time held me green and dying, though I sang in my chains like the sea. That's lyric poetry, folks, and they don't come any better than that. You notice the green and the gold? Fern Hill, yeah. Just a gorgeous, beautiful lyric poem. Now, I was halfway through that, I reminded that I had promised this lady here and a couple others, I was going to sneak in a couple of my poems, and I can't do it. Now, I've got to ask you, when are you leaving? What time tomorrow? 1:15, 1:45 bus? In the morning?
Yeah, that's right.
1:45.
No, I've got your book now. I found it.
Yeah, you found my book. All right. The other book's not in the bookstore, but I'm going to have to read. I promised you I was going to read. Now my voice is going anyway. When can we get together, and anybody else wants to hear some of my poems in the morning, I'll read mine. I was going to do it now, but once I get carried away with Dylan, there's no place for Ledbetter with Dylan Thomas.